Good evening.
Good evening.
Today is May 12, 2008, and I'm now with Mr. Peter Zaizai, who is Deputy Minister of National Security and Acting Minister of National Security for the Republic of Liberia. We are today in the Member Point Hotel in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Well, first, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Before we start, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent to this interview.
Yes, I've given my consent long time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to start by learning a little bit more about your personal background, and particularly the positions you've been in prior to becoming Acting Minister of National Security, and how did you get involved in police issues?
Well, my police career dated back almost about 15, 16, 17 years ago. When I graduated from high school in 1986, my first job that I did was to do a private security job where I worked with one group called the J3 Security Services as a way of financing my education at the university, because after graduation I was opportune to pass the placement exams at the University of Liberia and then enroll in 1987. So while in school, I also did private security job in the night, and that helped to facilitate my school. And then that continued a little while for 87, 88, you know, after I did some basic training, you know, before even doing the job with one former commandant of the National Police Training Academy, in person of the late George P. Kamukai. He became my first training officer and a role model who really inspired me to pursue career opportunities in law enforcement, particularly policing. And then they didn't stay too long. The war came in 1989, 1990. So 92, 93, I sat the aptitude test of the police, the Liberia National Police, and I happened to compress on the aptitude test out of 2,000 candidates. That qualified me to go to the academy. I did basic police training at the academy. I came out with flying colors. I came out first. I graduated with about 200 and something, you know, recruits. That gave me the opportunity to be a sworn police officer in the Liberia National Police. And I work within the patrol division, where we did routine patrol. I work at the Springfield at some point in time, and then central headquarters. And then later, based on my performance as a good investigator and a report writer, I was asked to transfer to the Criminal Investigation Division, where I spent the rest of my time. And then during the intermittent, you know, nature of our war, the civil conflict, I had a break, you know, within the Liberia National Police. And after 1997, 1998, I chose to work quietly, you know, within the Liberia National Police. I transferred to the Criminal Intelligence Unit. That gave me opportunity to do other things, you know, to work in other areas. So I work within the Corporate Development Agency, and then that gave me a better cover to report on a lot of things that we were doing, you know, within the police, putting on crime and other things. And then after the 2003 war, there was an opportunity, you know, that availed itself to me, and that has to do with some nomination that was done by a civil society or a political party nominated me for their slot. They nominated me for their slot within the government of the transitional government, Judy Bryant. And I went back to the police. I rose through the rank of the police, then as assistant director of police for press and public affairs. Position I served for 2 years plus until we were asked to resign in January 2006. And following my resignation, after a few months, I spent February, March, around about March, I was again nominated by the present president to based on the recommendation of the present Inspector General of Police, Honorable Beatrice Munansier, to serve as Deputy Director of Police for training and then Commandant of the National Police Training Academy. I served in that position from 2006 up to August 2007, where I was transferred, you know, from there to where I am presently to the Ministry of National Security as Deputy Minister for Administration. And basically that is a history of my own law enforcement career. And while in those positions I had the opportunity to do some basic training in peacekeeping support operations. I studied briefly a seminar, two seminars I had at the Kofi Annan Center, where I did media operations course. I also did a design development facilitation course that is in line with training. The media operation course was done in 2005, and the design development course was done in 2006 May. So these opportunities, you know, were available to me. And I also had the opportunity to travel to South Africa to participate in a IDASA organized program on security sector reform in post-conflict African societies. Okay, I represented Liberia National Police at that conference, which helped me to also do some comparative analysis of post-conflict societies' police reform efforts. And then I also did some assessment visit to the police training school in Sierra Leone to also do some comparative analysis to see how best we could improve our academy. And that gave me a deeper insight, you know, with respect to what was unfolding in our own country, and gave me an impetus to really press for improvement in our training facilities at the academy. So while at the academy, I had the opportunity to work closely with the United Nations, who happened to be involved with our reform, security sector reform effort, particularly the police. They being involved with the training of police officers. And my being there, I also raised a number of issues with them to see how best they could help us to own this training process so that our own Liberian value system could be inculcated into the trainees. That, you know, to some extent, I would say, has paid off well. And then we also raised the issue of helping us to improve the facilities at the academy since we were transitioning from conflict to peace. And that was also welcome. Today you go to the academy, there's a modern dormitory there. There is a modern classroom being constructed. All of these facilities are being constructed thanks to the understanding of the United Nations. They at least heard our concerns, and based on that, we were able to at least have those infrastructure. And I left in place able successors who, in my view, will be able to carry all those dreams that we had at the academy in terms of strengthening the capacity of the Liberia National Police. I stay at the police until we train and met the benchmark of the United Nations to train 3,500 police officers.
That was in 2007 that the benchmark was
reached. Yes, 2007 July. And right after that, I was, you know, transferred from the police to the LNP.
Well, we'll come back to your training experience through the interview, but before that, I'd like you to give us a brief overview of maybe the status of public order and crime since the end of the war, and maybe the major challenges that the Liberian National Police faced in the restructuring, its restructuring post-war.
Yeah, there is a huge challenge in terms of combating crime and in terms of combating public order. Because, as you are aware, this country is predominantly youthful. There were a lot of young people that participated in the 14, 15 years of civil conflict. on various sides of the conflict divide. And based on that, most of these young people became accustomed to lawlessness. Violence became the order of the day, and for 15 years, some of them, the young people were born into conflict, and they adopted conflict attitudes. And after the cessation of the hostilities, the DDR really was not tore off. Okay, it was incomplete because there was
disarmament and demobilization.
Yes, yes, disarmament, demobilization,
and reintegration,
rehabilitation, reintegration. The RR component of the DDRR, you know, is yet to be reinforced because when there is a conflict in society, people are traumatized because they witness horrific violent scenes, and that they become primary and both primary and secondary victims of conflict, and that in itself causes a lot of trauma. So most of the young people now we have in our society are traumatized. So the situation of crime and lawlessness are a huge security challenge, because one, the combatants, when the young people were combatants, they use drugs to stimulate them into becoming brave soldiers, as we call it. Some of them also were accustomed to grabbing valuable things. Now those valuable things are no longer around because we have a peaceful environment. So because of their conflict nature, their violent nature, they will still want to, you know, have access to those valuable things that they illegally took from people through violent means. So in the absence of that, you know, many of them lack basic skills besides the trigger-happy, you know, skill that they had. And in the absence of that, in the urban environment, the people lack basic skill, because the environment, the urban environment, is for people with skill. If you don't have a skill, then the possibility of finding a job or that will earn you an income honestly will be difficult. You know, so that is one of the contributing factors that is contributing to the wave of crime, you know, in our own Liberian society. And the youth unemployment, that also tie into that, because most of the young people who claim to be out of job don't really have the skill. So even if people have job to offer, they don't have the requisite skill to do the particular job. So there has to be some mechanism put into place to provide skills, and that could be tied into the rehabilitation programs, you know, of the United Nations or aid organizations in Liberia. And secondly, there has been no drug treatment program that they offer to, you know, ex-fighters. But there's no drug treatment program as we speak in this country, where people who have been accustomed to narcotic, you know, drugs or psychotropic, you know, substances could have some, you know, feeding of being rehabilitated, reformed, and reintegrated into normal societal life. So yes, this, you know, get most of the young people to be lawless, because of the violent nature that they went through, and it poses a huge challenge. Even those who have been enlisted into the services of the various security institutions, some of them participated in these violent conflicts, and some of them have violent orientation, witness violence scenes, so that could also have a playback on their mentality, on their attitudes in these various organizations. So the police, as police officers, as young people who have enrolled into the police, they could become violent because they don't have the opportunity to be rehabilitated and reintegrated because they witness violence, saying they may have either been primary or victim of conflict or trauma or secondary. So all of these things play into what is obtaining. And some of them, you know, witness criminal behavior or were involved in criminal activities, you know, during the course of the war. Those attitudes are still there, and if there is no mechanism to correct those behavior, it will have a playback in the profession or the vocational that they find themselves, either in the army, in the police, or whatever law enforcement institution they find themselves. Those antisocial behavior will surface, you know, and will have a backlash on society as a whole.
So the youth is the major issue. What are the most common types of crimes?
The most common types of crime are usually theft of property. And the issue of armed robbery is also tied in, because most of the robberies that are committed in town are really in the urban setting, particularly Monrovia, because this is where the whole complex has emptied as a result of the war. So sometimes they use machetes, sometimes they use, suddenly they use arms. But most of the armed robberies are being done by, are being committed with machetes. And they move, the robbers move in droves, they move in groups, you know, and they defy, they tend to defy the security presence. So when they move in groups, they attack, you know, communities, particularly helpless communities, people who are impoverished. And the victims are usually, you know, low income earners and maybe sometimes middle level people who really don't have the kind of protective opportunities, like live in fence or private security that are protecting their social. So that is a major issue. It speaks for itself, given the social economic disparity that we find in society. So those who have the means to provide private security, to pay for private security services, because private security is an extension of police function. And based on that, and those who can afford it, we hire private security to provide protection for them. They can also do a huge fence, put barbed wire, have lighting system, you know. And the city is dark. In the communities, you know, there are dark communities. Those who can afford generator will only use it for the early evening hour, maybe by 12 to cut it off. So the community goes dark. So criminals use those opportunities to also, you know, move in the communities to terrorize the residents of those communities. So the government is doing its best to providing light, you know, in the streets. When those lights move into the communities, we hope that will also help to curtail some of the criminal activity, because people will be indoor and will see you marching to their house to be able to identify you and you commit a crime. You know, police will be able to pick you up based on the identification that they provide. So yes, predominantly it's theft of property that is dominant, and then you also have armed robberies. Then added to that is the issue of rape also, and rape and the issue of even domestic violence. All of these things are a byproduct of the prolonged, you know, conflict situation that we have. Mm-hmm. 15 years, young people have become accustomed to violence and so forth. So it's like a playback, you know, of the violent years that we've had. So that is what is permeating our own society.
So the first area I'd like to talk about is the area of recruitment, recruitment strategies. So following the war, the former Liberian National Police was deactivated. Can you describe for us the process of recruitment and transition?
That's one of the areas where I had a problem. And every time I go to a forum, I raise this issue. The SSR process was fraught with a lot of problems. Because the mandate of the international community, you know, Liberia is a society in transition to peace, and because the state failed, it has to collapse, and when the state collapses, efforts have to be made to firstly reconstitute the state and make it a living state. That aspect, you know, is what that the government is fighting with. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the accord, the Comprehensive Peace Accord in Accra, signed 2003 August, gave a mandate to the United Nations and the international community to reform and restructure the police and other security apparatus, including the army. But it didn't tell them how to do it. Right, so the approach that was taken was, you know, approaches that were practiced in other societies, you know, and that didn't work. You know, the Liberian National Police had professionals, you know, some of us were there, and hundreds of us were in the police. And then when the United Nations came, they said everybody had to reapply. Okay. They said, before you stay in the police, you must be out of high school. There were people who have stayed in the police from patrol officer, constable. They went to schools, the university, they graduated, and they got degrees and other things. But when they came, people graduated from high school in the 70s. we were staying in the police in the 80s, and we fought war. People's homes were burned. People's documents got destroyed. Now, they insisted that you must produce document. All right? Now, if you went to the some of the schools that people went to no longer exist. They are either being destroyed or in ruins. Now, those institutions don't have or records to say they'll be able to trace, you know, records of these students. So sometimes they go to the Ministry of Education, they get a clearance, they say, look, you gotta bring some document to identify. But the clearance, you know, or the information that will be provided on the clearance, so that may not be accepted. So there were a lot of good guys who, you know, lost the opportunity to stay on in the police with a professional background. So that also hampered the recruitment process and the reform efforts of the police. The same thing went to the army. The same standard that they used in the police was the same standard they used in the army. So for the army, it was worse because they disbanded the whole organization. So institutional memory, you know, were not given consideration. So people who have stayed in the organization for 10, 15, 20 years, who needed to stay in the organization to even socialize the new guys into the organization were asked to leave. So you have a bulk of new people. So if you see the military today, they even had to have some ECOWAS, you know, member countries to contribute men to serve as company commanders. I mean, that is just ridiculous. Mm. You know, but these are the pains that we have to go through because we fought war. Mm. And we have to accept because they are giving the money, we don't have money. So we are like a failed state that is in desperate need of help to reconstitute our state to deliver those basic social services for our people. And that's why the government is like helpless because she needs all of the international friends, those who are making the resources available, so that and whatever they say, the government has no other option, because if you say no, they will carry their money because they give the money with conditions. Mm-hmm. So these are problems that we have, and that is why the some of the disparity you find in the reform effort. And even in the army, one of the key problems they have, you had a dying crop. Mm-hmm. It should have been a bilateral arrangement, government to government, but now the American government gave contract
to a private company.
Now, that private company is not even using their name to the reform process. What they are using is the SSR. So it should have been DENCOP, you know, providing training, but they are using SSR or PA. Mm. So DENCOP is like out of the
subcontracted.
You know, yeah, DENCOP is the one that subcontracted the whole thing to that. But the SSR is a process in Liberia, security sector reform. Mm. But it seemed to be a name of a process. Mm. You know, that is being ascribed to a particular organization performing one aspect of the routine. So that is even more confusing, because if they ask you who is training the army, they say SSR. You know, instead of saying train call, they'll say SSR, because all of the vehicles carry SSR. You know, so that is like a cover name for train call in the training process. That is more confusing. But that is not much of a problem. But the issue is, all of the guys who should have giving an institutional memory, because the history of the army, the history of the police, has been a history of America's involvement in the training processes. So it's just a question of new knowledge and new leadership.
So of the new police of 3,500 that you were describing, how many were re-recruited, if I may say, from the previous police?
You have basically overall just between 800 to 900 of the old guys. Those who, you know, wanted to stay, because some of the guys said they didn't want to be trained, because what did happen in the police, and the same thing is happening in the army, is that like you, Ato, has stayed maybe in the service for 10, 15 years. Mm-hmm. I have not worked with the service before. But if you choose to stay, they bring you down to zero, and then they ask me to train with you. So you must go to training and start at square one. Means that all of your training, your first training you had to work with the organization, and your experience you've accumulated over years, are giving no consideration. So some of the guys, most of the experienced guys felt that was humiliating. you know, it was demeaning, and they felt that, you know, they should pay their overnight leave. So, and that's how most of the good guys left the police, even the military. They said they would now sit with people who don't have military knowledge or police knowledge and go do training, you know, from square one. Because what we were advising then was that it is important to do a training of the present people you find in the organization. First, do a scanning of the organization. Get those who have served the organization for maybe 25 more years, who are old, you know, you could retire them. Those who still have age in their favor. All you needed to do was to give them some refresher courses at the academy and deploy them. They could help to socialize, give them new mandate, new orientation, and they could be able to help socialize the new guys that you've been recruiting. They could even help to spot suitable candidates. But again, those institutions that were disbanded, like the ATU, the SOD, and other things, some of the guys managed to come back into the organization under different names, under different guises, and so forth. And they are there. So you cannot be able to identify them. There were some experts who had human records. They managed to come in because the criteria was high school certificate. And if you could lay him on a high school certificate, or even somebody of a dear relative and so forth, you could use his name, you know, with the picture and come back to the organization.
So this is the issue of vetting? How was the vetting
done? The vetting was done predominantly by the United Nations. You know, vetting was done predominantly by the United Nations. And very little was done by the librarian staff. Mm-hmm. It was of late, after a series of heated debates, series of arguments and so forth, that people, you know, did that. Even those of us who were appointed to leadership positions, we had to go through the vetting. And we swallow those bitter pills because this is our country, we want to see our country move forward. Mm. I went through the vetting, I even went through some on-mail training program. Senior management training, I did that with on-mail for 3 months. I did a 1 week training for management course and so forth. 1 week, 3 months and so forth, intermittently. So all of these were processes that we went through, you know. And by and large, that is what has affected greatly the efficiency and the effectiveness of the police, even the military. So people are kind of skeptical as to whether these institutions will be able to really provide a kind of protection that the liberals really need in terms of sustaining democracy when the international community leaves. So these are key questions that we're trying to grapple with. Because there are a lot of, you know, bitterness, you know, amongst people who served their country loyally over time, and they felt that they were dishonorably removed, you know, from the service. So these are key concerns, these are security concerns, you know, that we'll have.
In terms of now moving to the training and professionalization, you started talking about it.
Yeah.
With the fact that everyone had to go through training. How was, can you describe some of the training programs? Who was, who designed the training curriculum and who delivered most of the training?
Before I went to the academy from 2005, when the training started around July, all of the training was conducted by HOMIL, the United Nations, people from different countries.
Before 2005, so from 2003
to 2005. 2003 to 2004, these were development periods. They were developing a curriculum and other stuff. So by 2005, the actual training started to some extent. Between 2004 July, the training started. 2004 July. And there was some in-service training program that were conducted. Even those that went through those in-service training programs with the United Nations, about 600 of them, a good number of them were deactivated. You know, and if you didn't go back for the vetting, it means you were disqualified, you were paid off, and you left. But they had this 24 weeks or 36 weeks program. You had 12 to 13 weeks, you know, academic work at the academy, and then you went out for 24 weeks, and then you came back for another 4 weeks to complete, you know, your basic choir course. So that amounted to almost about 10 months training. But in terms of getting more information, the time for acquiring more information was limited, because that was about 3 to maybe 12 weeks. That was just about 3 months. So the curriculum where you have to really exhaustively deal with some of the core courses, you know, were very limited. So most of the thing was done practically. People were mentorship, what we call field training. You had to, you spent on 4 weeks in field training, and then you come back, you know, and do academic work for about another 4 weeks to validate your graduation.
Mm.
And that went on for some time until we got there. We began to press that, look, this has to be changed. We needed more academic work, people to have more practical, you know, theoretical knowledge about the work that they are going to do, and less field work. So it was like cut down, you know, again, they increased the time to 16 weeks academic work, and then you go into field training for, say, 9 weeks, and then you come back again for another 4 weeks. So it came down to 24. You know. So this is how the training process was about. Basically, and then some of the guys that they train, who didn't have real records or history of policing, were recruited and trained as teachers, as trainers.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself has some problem.
Okay, so you know, trainers were trained.
Yeah,
and
from those that they trained. Uh-huh. In the
so did Liberian trainers start, when did they start taking over part of the training?
Liberian trainers started taking active part in the training the later part of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2006 to 2007. Right now, most of the training are being done by Liberians.
Yeah.
But the question now is, some of the guys who are providing the training is like, they cannot really lay here, they cannot give you a practical experience of field work.
Yeah.
Because they just came from the classroom, because it was their first experience in the profession.
Yeah.
You know, that really has some, you know, negative impact. It speaks of the kind of quality output that we have in the organization, because you need to link some of the training with some basic experiences in your own career. But we didn't have that. There are a few of the guys who are still with the organization for some time, you know, were in the process, were in that process, I think one or two of them. So we said that, look, you needed not to do away with the old instructors. All you needed to do was to retrain them and give them a specific mandate as to what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the curriculum, sit with them, develop a comprehensive curriculum. But they look at the curriculum and they just grab something and then add others that they think should have been there. So some of the important courses that, you know, should have been taught at the academy were left out.
Such as
discipline courtesy, or city academic geography, where you teach the people about your city outlook, the government officials, or diplomatic immunity to respect, you know, diplomats, those who are supposed to be, you know, giving courtesy and whatever, the level or some detailed information about testifying in court.
Mm.
Give them the practical way of
for investigation.
How do you testify in court? So all of these basic things were left out. So detailed investigation. So
how was the curriculum? How were the curriculum designed? Was it based on previous curriculum that existed prior?
Yeah, to some extent. You know, policing is universal. So most of the courses, you know, that were here were borrowed from that of America, because it's America that has been our role model, and they're giving sort of the academy and so forth in the late 50s. Okay, and based on that, those courses that were there were no much different from other courses that are taught in other academies. But in terms of the history and culture of the Liberian National Police, the doctrine, the value, you know, they were really totally overlooked, because all of the Liberian instructors at the academy were asked not to participate in the training on the initial stages.
Mm.
It was people from Pakistan, from places like Turkey, Nigeria, Ghana, you know, Jamaica. You know, possible other places, Serbia, other places. People who even joined those police forces in other post-conflict countries, who were just recruited too with no detailed experience. You know, them to
the physical academy, the building had been destroyed during the war?
No, but
it had
Yeah, some were destroyed, but it was severely looted. Yeah, the documents, but there were some.
So the trainings are not taking place in the same building that used
to
be the academy?
It was taking place initially. The first initial training that they had, it took place in the building. Some classrooms were there. But now, when they decided to do the full-scale training, they erected tents. The tents were used for 2004 up to just some part of last year. They started, moving the tent one. When we insisted that they needed to build a dormitory, but some of the tents are still there. So they started using the dormitory. They used tents. They bought a prefab kitchen. That's why we said that they needed to refurbish the facilities that we had there and then build new structures. And we insisted on that, and they saw reason, and we have new structures there now. We renovated the dormitory that was there, expanded it, cafeteria. And I'm told that they moved there now with those items, and they're building a new classroom, by the old classroom. So those facilities are there. We're working on them.
So you mentioned some of the courses that were left out, that are sort of missing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, generally, how would you say that the training met the objectives? What were these objectives? And now, in terms of the ability of the police to do their work, how well did the training meet the objectives?
To some extent, the public, the output is the public that is evaluating the performance of the police. And the fact that the police continue to be, condemned, continue to be lambasted at, shows that there are a lot of shortcomings, in the whole process. And the objectives, in terms of meeting of the objective, actually may have had some shortfall, but generally, on the average, the materials were taught, to the trainees or the present guys. They may have some technical knowledge about it, but in the application, because they did not have real practical, experienced people teaching them, they have some shortcomings. But on the average, yes, at least they have police knowledge. You know what they're supposed to be doing. They taught them the Constitution of the Republic of Liberia. They taught them the Code of Ethics. That's one issue that they left out, the Code of Ethics of a police officer. Other things. And once these things are missing, where people are not rigorously made to memorize some of these values in the police Code of Ethics, at least one to, and then the testing methods. The testing methods were not really, they were not comprehensive. So it was like multiple choice, yes or no answer, true or false. These are not really, issues that can really evaluate trainees objectively, But once you see the high school, they should be able to write some composition, to write their own experience and other things. But those things were not done. These are issues that we raise with them. So the misbehavior sometimes, you see, is a result of ignoring some of the advice that people give.
You mentioned that the public is the one evaluating. What are some of the main complaints that come from the public?
The public is saying that the police has not changed. They have said that the police has not changed. The police is aggressive.
Aggressive.
The police is brutal. The police it's not fair, does not treat the citizen fairly, it's biased, all of these sort of things, to the extent that they made the president to some point in time, get really annoyed with some of the key issues. So once the citizens continue to raise this issue, we hope that some of the retraining, because even at that, we designed some in-service training program where we carry some of the guys for in-service training program for 1 month, some of them for 3 weeks, at various levels, senior management, middle management, commanders, investigation course, information course, all of these things were taught. But people are still not internalizing the profession. They look at the profession from more profit-making venture than really delivering services to the people. That is a point of departure we have. That is undermining their own professionalism in the service. And that is why that is tending to cover the objectives, making it to appear that really the training objective was not met because of people went to the force for various reasons, to protect their interests, to protect family interests, protect the interests of friends and so forth, or sometimes to also use it to revenge on other people. So that is why you found various behavior. There are some people in the organization who are really practicing professionalism, yes, but on the average, there are a lot of problems that we experience very well.
Moving to the next area would be integration and amalgamation of services. There seem to be a number. There are a number of security, different security services. A number of them belonging to the police, in Liberia. What are the prospects for possible amalgamation or integration of these, and what are the
those
discussions?
Those views are being expressed, and I think they fall in good ears. The consideration we gave it to it by the government.
What are the rationals for?
The rationale provided is that most of the organization are overlapping function. Mm. That's one key issue that they said, and they also talk about capacity. And then
how many different services are there?
We have the police. We have the police. We have the Minister of National Security, where I work. You have the National Security Agency. You have the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Let's interrupt for a second.